Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A comforting return to orthodoxy, two guests, after last week's radical departure. Colette Shade will talk about her new book in the Y2K era, the days when the internet was young and effortless prosperity seemed eternal. And Tim Shorrock will explain what's been going on in South Korea, where a right-wing president declared martial law, a move that was promptly reversed by the National Assembly, which just as promptly impeached him. But he's using his palace guard to prevent his arrest for insurrection. It's easy to get nostalgic for the late 1990s. I published a book 22 years ago that denounced the stock market bubble and the new economy mania of the time as a ludicrous fraud, but given the darkness of our present, my mind does drift back with some pleasure to the time of supermodels, indie rock, IPOs, and dial-up modems. Who can blame me, given the imminence of Trump and the horrifying fires in Los Angeles? My friend Colette Shade is just out with a book, Y2K, How the 2000s Became Everything, Essays on the Future That Never Was, published by Day Street Books. It's an engaging and thoughtful mix of personal essay and cultural history about a period that has seen remarkably little scrutiny. Besides the book, Colette has written on a variety of topics, from the racist history of the Maryland State Song to Edith Wharton, for publications like Interview, The New Republic, The Baffler, and Gawker. Colette Shade. The Y2K era was more than just the transition from December 31st, 99 to January 1st, 2000. How do you date it?
I date it from 1997 through 2008. So basically the rise of the dot-com bubble and the popping of the housing bubble.
Bracketed by bubbles.
Yes, bracketed by bubbles. Now, you could make an argument that, well, actually the dot-com bubble technically started in August 1995 with the Netscape IPO, but I'm writing a book of personal essays here, so I took some liberties in terms of what I wanted to cover. And also, I feel that the kind of cultural influence of the dot-com bubble didn't start to take effect until around 1997. So that's what I picked. I was inspired specifically for that year because, one, that's when I came into political consciousness. And two, there's this incredible July 1997 Wired cover that says something like, the next 25 years will be full of peace and prosperity for everybody.
Yes, that was the utopianism of that era was really remarkable.
Yes.
So what were its prominent characteristics? What makes it a coherent era?
I can say this here on your podcast, because I think your listeners will know what I'm talking about. It was characterized by a particular type of political subjectivity in the sense that there is this understanding that after the Cold War ended in 1991, and then with the rise of the dot-com bubble and the booming stock market in the late 90s, there's this idea that, well, American-led free market capitalism was the best system possible. Our winning the Cold War had proved that so. And there was just really no reason to be politically involved any more than voting, maybe. So there's this idea that we had just figured out all of these old historical conflicts. So we had solved the problem between labor and capital by doing away with unions and instead giving everyone 401ks. Why do you need a union when you can just get rich in the stock market? And then there's this idea that we're going into this new millennium that, like Wired magazine said, was going to be an era of unprecedented peace and prosperity for all. And then 9/11 happens, and that certainly disrupts the peace part, but it doesn't disrupt the prosperity part. 9/11 obviously, well, not just 9/11, but the U.S. global war on terror that was initiated after 9/11, that certainly instigated an anti-war movement and a protest movement, but it was really relatively small in American life and, in my opinion, not that influential and widespread. I think the reason why is because you could fundamentally act like the war on terror wasn't happening. What did President George W. Bush tell us to do after 9/11? We're supposed to go shopping and get down to Disney World. Or I'm thinking of like this cover of Entertainment Weekly with an American flag on it that came out a couple weeks after 9/11. And it was like, what's next? The challenge for our culture. Yeah, 9/11 marked a cultural shift, but it didn't really mark a shift in terms of how I think most Americans saw their role as political actors. And it wasn't until 2008, when the housing bubble collapsed and initiated the Great Recession, that it actually disrupted life in a material way. And so people lost their jobs, people lost their homes, their savings. And because of this widespread material discontent, there was this searching among a much wider population in terms of who can we blame for this? And some of that searching led to the Bernie movement. It led first to Occupy Wall Street, then to the Bernie movement, DSA, and the millennial left, and just the growth of the left in the US more generally. But it also led to Trump. It also led to conspiracy theories like QAnon and anti-vaccine beliefs. Yeah, it just marked a totally different political era from the one bracketed by those two bubbles.
It's funny, the prosperity of the first part of the period you're talking about was a byproduct of a stock market bubble. Prosperity of the second half of the period was a byproduct of a housing bubble. Nobody seemed to notice that the underlying fundamentals of the political economy were pretty shabby.
Right, exactly. I can see it now that a lot of this prosperity was fairly illusory.
You open the book with a view of the future, your view of the future from 1999. What did you see, the young Colette?
In 1999, I wrote this time capsule letter. So my elementary school was making a millennium time capsule, and I guess everyone in my class had been assigned to predict what a different year in the new millennium would look like. And the year I got was 2008. Now, of course, I didn't predict the entire global economy melting down and pensions losing a third of their value and multiple major banks failing or being on the verge of failure. What I predicted was that in 2008, I would be a junior at Stanford University. We would have cured all of cancer, just all of it. We would all be watching our movies on the internet, and we would be listening to pop music that was heavily produced by computers. And I think that the phrase I used was musicians will use computers for their voices or something.
That's not far off.
It's not far off, right? Like, I did get a couple things right.
But you didn't go to Stanford. What was it about Stanford that so appealed to your young fantasy?
So my uncle, who I'm very close to, my mom's brother, he had gone to Stanford in the 70s. He actually, like a lot of people back then, was able to graduate at 16 because they used to skip you if you were good at school. They used to like skip you in grade. And so at 16, he went off to Stanford. He was there for a little while and then he dropped out. He did more like Bay Area countercultural stuff, ended up enrolling in another college, doing the counterculture thing for a while, and then later got sick of the kind of bohemian broke lifestyle and was able to get a job at Intel because he had taken some computer science classes. And back in the 70s, you could just walk in.
That was not an unusual career path.
Exactly. Right. And that's why I tell this story, because one of the things that I wanted to do with my book was to situate my own life story within a broader narrative. So I don't see my uncle or myself or any of the other quote unquote characters in this book as being particular. I mean, they are, of course, but they are tropes. They are people of their time. And in that time, if you were a middle class white man, baby boomer in the Bay Area, you could go very easily from the counterculture to working at a new company like Intel and basically enter the professional managerial class that way.
Some of those folks brought with them the hippie idealism of their previous life, and they transferred it to tech.
Right. And they saw tech as a place of utopian possibility. Fred Turner has a very good book called From Counterculture to Cyberculture. And it's about how a lot of countercultural people in the Bay Area found themselves in the nascent tech sector and helped build Silicon Valley with these hippie ideals. What he kind of argues, though, is that the hippie ideals were actually a lot more libertarian and even conservative than I think is widely understood. Like, a lot of the people who were involved with the Whole Earth Catalog and homesteading in the West, they saw themselves as cowboys and frontiers people. they actually saw cyberspace as the next frontier to be conquered.
Very individualistic, nothing collective.
Very individualistic, right, nothing collective. One line that my uncle has, he has a lot of funny lines. He would always describe himself as a born-again capitalist.
I hope his soul is saved now. Let's talk about some of the specifics. I think it's called Larry Summers Caused My Eating Disorder. tell us how that happened.
So that chapter started with a joke because I was talking to my agent and I was telling him that I really wanted to write a story about having an eating disorder in the Y2K era, which was a very common story for women. The media was really misogynistic then and really picked on women's bodies and like was constantly talking about really average weight or even slightly below average weight celebrities as being fat. Like I remember Mariah Carey, who's a very average or below average weight woman. Some tabloid said she had fat thighs. So that was the whole vibe back then. This was pre-body positivity. There's this real pro-eating disorder vibe going on. And I always felt that the explanations of eating disorders and why I had an eating disorder were insufficient. My mom, who is a second wave feminist, would say, oh, well, you're reading too many fashion magazines, because I've always been and still am very interested in fashion and beauty and things like that. She would sort of have this line like, oh, you know, you need to stop reading Vogue and consuming so much mass media, because that's what's giving you your eating disorder. I think that that certainly helped my eating disorder develop, but I've never felt that that was the full story. And I've always felt that there was something more. So the story I tell in Larry Summers Caused My Eating Disorder is that I was anorexic. I was, you know, calorie restricting for a while. And then that turned into binging and purging, which is common because when you calorie restrict for long enough, you get really hungry, but then you still have this idea that you can't have a certain amount of food. Anyway, so I wanted to tell this story. And what feels true to me is that the calorie restriction was an internalization of neoliberal logic. So if you actually look at the terminology used around personal responsibility and neoliberal words, John Patrick Leary has a good book called Keywords, where he talks about capitalist body talk. So these are terms like lean, flexible. These are terms that are used to describe governments or companies, but these are also terms that are used in diet culture and in like tabloids when they're saying, oh, you know, Lindsay Lohan's looking lean. So I see my eating disorder as a reflection of neoliberal values.
I should say that Larry Summers, I've seen him up close and personal. Doesn't look like he skipped many meals. This is a thing that affected women far more than men.
Oh, yes, yes. Right, because women were basically told that part of managing your human capital is being very skinny. And I just took that very literally, as did many women at the time. So I use Larry Summers as a stand-in because I'm talking about two different sides of neoliberalism. I'm talking about it domestically. I'm talking about the culture of austerity and personal responsibility in the United States. And I was picking up on that because I was in high school. I was a couple years out from college and I was really struggling in high school. I have some learning disabilities and I was really having a hard time. And I was very, very, very anxious about getting into college. And I remember looking at the bell curves of SAT scores and where I stood with particularly my math SAT score and thinking, oh my God, it's like I need to be in like the top quartile and I'm like in the bottom quartile. And then with the body, I remember feeling like there was a confluence between, I hope this makes sense, but when you're a kid and you go to the pediatrician will bring out the bell curve to show where you stand on the bell curve. And I was always actually on the far left quadrant because I was always very skinny. And then when I went through puberty, I became a more average weight. And I think a lot of my neuroses and anxiety about my ability to function within the economy turned into me restricting calories so that I would go back down to that bottom quartile. Because that, of course, with skinny, you want to be, you know, the bottom quartile, not the top quartile.
I'm speaking with Colette Shade, author of Y2K, How the 2000s Became Everything, Essays on a Future That Never Was, from Day Street Books. The other part of the Larry Summers angle was that he was very instrumental in redesigning what happened to the former Soviet Union. And a lot of the models of the period, the very skinny, ethereally blonde models, were from the former Soviet Union. So Larry had a hand in that, too.
Yes, exactly. And so I get into it on, like I said, the domestic end, but I also get into how neoliberalism looked in a place like the former Soviet Union, where you had the biggest peacetime drop in life expectancy due to neoliberal reforms in the early 90s. So you have just this huge population of financially desperate people. And one of the changes that happened throughout the 90s in this newly quote-unquote free Russia is that the modeling industry boomed. The journalist Peter Pomerantsev found that more than half of models, I think by like the late 90s, early 2000s, were from the former Soviet Union. And there's a specific reason for that. Part of it was that a lot of them are white and they have, and blonde, they have characteristics that are desirable, like physically, but so do Norwegians. And you don't see disproportionate number of, say, Scandinavians. And my argument there is that, well, Scandinavians have a welfare state. You don't have to become a model and to maybe support your family. And not only that, but the fact that you're coming from a country with a welfare state makes you less desirable as a model. Because one of the things that model scouts would say was so desirable about the girls in Russia, a lot of the women who were recruited for modeling internationally were like 12, 13, 14, 15. They didn't speak English very well. They're financially desperate. And so they could very easily be taken advantage of and they wouldn't be able to stand up for themselves. I felt that that was very important to also dig into. And the way I tie it all together is because I start the essay by talking about one of my favorite Vogue editorials of all time. And I love this editorial. It's very beautiful and artfully done. But it features Natalia Vodianova, who was, well, still is, but was at the time, you know, one of the biggest supermodels in the world, who had this story. She was like the success version of the narrative I just described. So she came from a poor family. She had been selling fruit on the street to support her family and her disabled sister. And she was like dating some sort of gangsterish guy. She's like 17, 18. And then her boyfriend was like, hey, you should go to this modeling casting call. And she did. And she was picked. And then she shipped off to Paris, learned English, and then ended up becoming one of the best supermodels in the world. But of course, that's a very rare occurrence. Most of the models who even were picked from these casting calls would not become like multimillionaires and the face of Calvin Klein Euphoria.
It's funny, as I was reading that chapter, I was thinking, you know, those supermodels used to be household names. And now we don't really have anything comparable, which says something about, I don't know, the changes in fashion, but also the changes in celebrity.
Oh, yeah. I think that there's, yeah, I also have a separate chapter about celebrity where I talk about how there used to be a very clear line in the Y2K era of who's a celebrity and who's not. And sure, within celebrity, you would have A-list, B-list, C-list, D-list. But there's like this clear line, whereas now with social media and with the fragmenting of culture due to that, there's not really a clear line. Like, we're all sort of celebrities in our own way. You know, Doug, you're a celebrity. I'm a celebrity in a very, very small way. And then big celebrities don't have the same kind of household name recognition as someone like a Jennifer Aniston or an Angelina Jolie or Lindsay Lohan, Britney or Natalia Vodianova in the 2000s.
It was also the era of bling rap. And you have some interesting material in the book about how white suburban kids embraced it. What was going on there?
So in the mid-90s, rap starts to fully enter the mainstream of pop culture. Whereas, I mean, obviously it was huge, like Run DMC was huge in the 80s. Rap was really getting bigger and bigger throughout the 80s and 90s. But it was really around like 1996, 97 when it crossed over into being like this is pop culture versus this is like this ancillary side thing. So part of that was the Biggie and Tupac feud and their murders. There are a bunch of other reasons for it. After Kurt Cobain died and grunge sort of faded out, there wasn't really a big rock movement. And so hip hop came in and kind of took the place of mainstream youth rebellion. It was around 1997 where rap became pop culture. And also around that time, you got a new aesthetic and movement basically within rap, which is now called bling rap, which is, think about like Lil Wayne and Cash Money, their song Bling Bling, which came out in 1999. It's them throwing money around, sitting on yachts, driving around luxury cars, hanging out with half-nude women in a mansion. And the whole song is just sort of this celebration of getting rich. And so this was very popular at the time, and it was popular from around 1997 through 2008. And to be clear, this was not the only rap that was happening. There was a lot of independent rap. There was like all kinds of other stuff that was going on. But this was the mainstream face of what rap was. There was this particular affect that certain white people, in my experience, had towards this type of rap, which was a stand-in for rap in general, which was like, oh, look at those rappers with their big chains, throwing money around, saying the F slur, talking about gang banging and dealing drugs, treating women like property, you know, as they writhe around on the floor with a bunch of cash. Look at them. They are so misogynistic, homophobic, materialistic, and violent. And yes, they were those things, sure. But there's this idea that hip hop itself was bringing those qualities into American culture. And you also got that too from adult pundits who were fretting about the influence of hip hop and rap. And there's this idea that it was like bringing in these alien, scary values versus reflecting back things that are just a part of American life and culture. So one of the interesting things about rap, though, is at that time, is that a lot of it did in fact reflect what was going on in broader culture. And so, for example, Jay-Z has a song called Takeover, and he's talking about a takeover of drug territory or a takeover of like rap territory, if you will, culturally. But you could read this as like a reflection of the corporate takeovers that were happening at the time. He has another song where he compares dealing crack with doing legitimate business. And basically his conclusion is that they're the same thing. There's a clip song in the book from 2007 where they talk about dealing crack as a way to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be self-reliant and entrepreneurial. And I compare this line for line to a speech from President Clinton a few years earlier about ending welfare reform as we know it. Really, I see the messages in rap as reflecting things that were happening within American life. Another example would be there's pervasive militarism within rap. No Limit, they have their tank. There's a song called Soldier by Destiny's Child featuring Lil Wayne and T.I. And T.I. is talking about how he's the general. He has purple hearts on him. And Lil Wayne is saying, oh, mommy, join my troop. Every time she hears my name, she salutes. Another example would be T.I. has a song where he says that he's wild as the Taliban, 9 in my right, 45 in my other hand. And this is like, to me, was like a way of processing all of the violence that was going on before the war on terror, but particularly after the global war on terror and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But then there would be this like reaction from certain white people or where it would be like, oh, look at this violence that's getting brought into America. It's not like the entire structure of American power is violent. There's a particular white affect that I don't think is considered so widely socially acceptable anymore, but there was this thing where white people who did not really particularly ally themselves or immerse themselves in hip hop culture would temporarily take on the affect of a rapper. So here's an example. There was a popular series of dance parties in Williamsburg around 2006 that were hosted by a white DJ named Da Pumpsta. And all of these white indie sleaze hipsters were encouraged to just come and like dress like rappers. And for some of them, it was wearing like tall tees and fake bling. For others, it was literally wearing blackface. To me, that's almost like there's something very Freudian there in the sense that it's a way to temporarily embody these really gross things about American life that you've then projected onto these other people and then take off your costume and be like, oh, actually, that's not me. That's those people over there. There's something going on with the return of the repressed.
The Y2K era, there was an energy and optimism to it, as pathological as it all was. Today, everything seems so gloomy and dark. The internet then was bursting with optimism. It was a fraudulent optimism, but it felt better in today's tech culture, which is dominated by reactionary authoritarians like Musk and Thiel. I almost start getting nostalgic for the 90s reading your book. What's going on? Is there a 90s nostalgia brewing?
Yeah, there is. So there's a Y2K era nostalgia. Like you'll see on Instagram, TikTok, all of these Y2K nostalgia accounts that have old scans of Teen People magazine or catalogs from the late 90s, early 2000s, or little video clips of pop culture from then. You also get people who are either millennials or Gen Z who didn't live through this actually dressing up in like the low-rise flares, body glitter, and butterfly hair clips. Part of that is this thing that I call like the nostalgia marketing cycle, where at around the 20 and 30 year mark of pop culture, that gets recycled into nostalgia because that's how long it takes for the people who grew up with that culture the first time around as kids to become adults who are making culture themselves and also adults who have some disposable income to spend on it. So you could actually see that in the Y2K era with the 70s. You had the 70s show. What was the most popular style of jeans? It was bell bottoms. Of course, they're called flares, but they're bell bottoms. You had Led Zeppelin in a Cadillac commercial. And so you do have this cyclical thing that happens, but I do think that there's a difference between, say, the boomer nostalgia for the 70s that was happening in the Y2K era and the contemporary nostalgia for the Y2K era that's happening now. What's different is that in the Y2K era, the boomers were like, oh, well, our stock portfolio is growing and we own property. And now for a lot of millennials, with the exception of the wealthiest ones, that just isn't the case. Or even if it is the case, they bought a house and they have a retirement fund. The world just looks so scary between climate change and all the wars and political instability, Trump coming back into office, these people like Musk and Thiel running around, seemingly dictating policy. It's very, very scary. So I think that a lot of the Y2K or nostalgia is a nostalgia for the time basically before 2008 or even before 9/11, right? Like it's a nostalgia for this time that was seemingly uniquely peaceful and prosperous. And what I think makes the millennial cohort unique is that we came into political consciousness being told that everything was going to be uniquely peaceful and prosperous. And then as soon as we entered adulthood, it flipped and everything went from like, you guys are going to live in a utopia to you guys are going to live in a dystopia. And I think that that's different from even like Gen Z, because they came into political consciousness in the dystopia. They weren't sold anything else than the dystopia. Seeing that flip right at this pivotal moment as we were entering adulthood, I think was very traumatic for millennials. And I think that a lot of our nostalgia for the pop culture of that time is partially a nostalgia for that different political economy.
I was Colette Shade, author of Y2K from Day Street Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. Don't say goodbye, I'm a hot little mama. The number one stunner, slim skin copper. Like bear bro, I need that gravy proper. Got a money fetish, wanna see me where your bed is? Playboy, y'all got to give me five letters. Like Prada, Jacob, Fendi, Boots, C, Dior, Chloe, Suits, Range, Rover, Gucci, Shoes, First Class, Flat Class, Paras. Too many cowards alive.
Fox Brown, Bonnie, minus the Clyde. And today, I'ma make this one promise to God. Even if I go wood, I'ma keep it so hood. And I got chills when I signed my deal. And I shed tears when Biggie and Pop got killed.
That was a bit of Fallen by Foxy Brown from 2001. I auditioned a few other songs for this part, but most of them would have put us at risk for a fine from the FCC. Next, the political crisis in South Korea. On December 3rd, President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law for no apparent reason other than longing to be a dictator amidst deep unpopularity. South Koreans suffered under military rule for several decades after the end of World War II, when the country was freed from Japanese rule. Yoon's declaration brought millions into the streets protesting his power grab. Why? Who is Yoon? Why this crisis? Where will it all go? To answer these questions, we're joined by Tim Shorrock. Tim grew up in South Korea and Japan and has been writing about both countries and U.S. imperial designs on them for decades. He's been covering the current crisis for Dropsite News, a project founded by Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill. Tim talks about Gwangju, which was the site of a 1980 rebellion against military rule, which the government suppressed at the cost of hundreds of lives. Despite that defeat, it was an important milestone in the eventual establishment of democracy in the country in 1987. Tim Shorrock. Before we discuss the recent goings-on, which are quite dramatic, who is Yoon Suk-yeol?
Yoon Suk-yeol, he's a former prosecutor. That's where he came from. He never had any political experience, really, before he was drafted as his conservative party's nominee for president in 2022. Really right-wing, very pro-Japanese. You know, his father was educated in Japan, so he was like his typical kind of right-wing pro-Japan politician from like the 1960s.
What does it mean to be pro-Japan in the Korean context?
In his context, the big thing that the Biden administration was so happy about Yoon Suk-yeol was that he had cut an agreement with Japan that allowed them to join together in this trilateral alliance with the United States. Japan and Korea couldn't move forward on anything like that until they had dealt with Japan's refusal to compensate people that were forced into slave labor or prostitution during World War II, right? This has been a long-standing issue. In 2023, Yoon Suk-yeol went to Japan and met with then-Japanese Prime Minister Kishida and basically let Japan completely off the hook. They signed this agreement where Japan sort of acknowledged using slave labor, but it didn't have to pay any reparations. All the costs were on the Korean side. The South Korean government, you know, the victims of the slave labor are supposed to pay the reparations. And a lot of Koreans thought this was a complete sellout. But of course, you know, he was praised to the skies by Biden and Blinken as a great diplomat, you know, willing to overcome past differences and so on. But he sold out.
And this is all about an alliance against China, right?
Well, basically, yeah. But this trilateral alliance between Japan and Korea, you know, has been in the works. I mean, the Pentagon has been wanting it for decades. China was just an excuse. That was how they talked about it when it was formed in the summer of 2023. It's been in the works for a long time. And there was this open, you know, normalization between South Korea and Japan in 1965 that the U.S. really wanted also. And ever since then, the U.S. has been pushing for a closer relationship between South Korea and its former colonizer. And so now it reached fruition under Biden and Blinken, who also had this very hard line on North Korea, which was no talks unless they give up their nuclear weapons, and also just building up the U.S. military presence in Korea and Japan. Japan's participation in this alliance was made possible in part by agreeing to greatly expand their military budget, but also by some new laws that will allow Japanese forces to attack an enemy base for the first time since 1945. And that's something the U.S. had also been pushing for. What that means is future war with North Korea or with China over Taiwan, Japan forces could attack an enemy base in Taiwan or China or whatever under this alliance with the U.S. and South Korea. So that was also a major change. And so he went along with this. So as a result of the Biden and Yoon approach in Korea, tensions have skyrocketed with North Korea. They've been testing long-range missiles, as they have been for quite a while. And the U.S. has, you know, had these huge shows of force, right, with this new trilateral force where a U.S. B-52 bomber will fly across Korean skies with Japanese and Korean fighters next to it. This, you know, real big military buildup that's happened. Yun was key to that because he supported this strong militaristic line inside of Korea. His popularity went down to like below 10%. His regime was corrupt, super anti-labor, right? Real big crackdowns on unions. And instead of reviving the old Red Scare by talking about his political opponents as pro-North Korea, he did this attempted coup on December 3rd.
Yeah, okay. So what prompted this attempt declaring martial law, which was reversed a few hours later, but what was behind that?
He claims that his opponents, like the Democratic Party of Korea, which actually has a majority in the National Assembly, the past president, the more progressive president, Moon Jae-in, was the former leader of that party. He said basically, you know, Parliament wasn't doing anything to help his agenda that he was elected for. He thought that the investigations of his wife for corruption were politically motivated. He claimed that they were trying to turn the country into North Korea, basically accusing them of being pro-communist North Koreans. He's also someone who relies on shamans. Apparently, he had enough people in the military willing to go along with him, at least in the first stages, to launch this coup. And it was just such a shock to people because it was the first time since, you know, 79 and 80 that martial law had been imposed. It was like 44 years, right? It was such an extreme measure. What's come out since then, since the people swarmed to the National Assembly and all these assembly people were able to get in to the National Assembly building and reverse his martial law proclamation. The struggle's still going on. You know, there's an arrest warrant out for him, and his presidential detail has refused to allow him to be arrested, and it's just a standoff going on right now.
Yeah, that's wild. They tried to serve papers on him, and his palace guard prevented them from doing it. That's really crisis material there.
The thing is, like, they're adopting the stop the steal language that the MAGA people did and Trump did, you know, after the last election in the U.S., right? And they're talking about the parliamentary elections, National Assembly elections that took place about last year. There's all this like fake news going around on right-wing websites that vote was fixed and so on. And so they're saying the votes were stolen. And I mean, there is this very vocal and strong ultra-right in South Korea, and they go out and they're these demonstrations they've had to supposedly protect him from arrest, they fly American flags and they have all these, you know, pro-Trump slogans, and they think somehow the U.S. is going to save them. And they have all these right-wing backers here in the United States, you know, repeating this kind of language. But, you know, like, it was just an absurd reach of power. And he wanted his martial law forces, and these were special forces. These were, like, highly trained to, you know, fight a war with North Korea. The plan was to arrest the leaders of all the political parties. And also, it turns out that some of his generals were trying to spark some kind of response from North Korea that they could use as, you know, we have to crack down because North Korea is about to invade, that kind of thing. His plans were really insidious, what he was trying to do. And, you know, they didn't get away with it. And you know, millions of people have turned out in the streets, in the freezing cold, to call for his removal and his arrest and impeachment. You know, the impeachment is going to go on because it's managed by a constitutional court, you know, once the National Assembly votes, which they did. But removing him from office is the next step, and that's what's proven to be so difficult. It shows you that there's real elements of within South Korean right of yearning for this martial law period from under past dictatorships like Chun Doo-hwan and Park Chung-hee. I think that's what he was reaching for. But the Korean people don't want anything like that ever again. The first words out of a lot of people, like when I was reporting it for Drop Site News that first 24 hours, The first thing I did was contact people that were in Gwangju that I know had been part of the resistance in the past, because I was concerned that, you know, they were going to be arrested, right? That's what usually happens in martial law. They go out and they arrest anyone who is on their blacklist. The people I talked to there and in Seoul were just astonished that he would try this, because there is so much opposition to ever having military rule again. What I think is so shameful is how the U.S. built up this guy, Biden and Blinken. They wanted to nominate him for a Nobel Peace Prize for his the way he caved to Japan, which they thought was great diplomacy, but he has no diplomacy about him. There's reports in the Korean press today about how he has a terrible drinking problem, and he would stay up real late with all his buddies and get really drunk and then start talking about martial law. So this guy is not quite there, and he's really done things that people never imagined they would see again.
I'm speaking with the journalist Tim Shrock. Now, he was impeached by the National Assembly, which, like here, is the equivalent of an indictment, not a conviction. So there has to be a trial. What's that look like?
Well, the trial is going to be before this constitutional court. One of the things that's complicated it in recent weeks was that constitutional court, which has upheld the impeachment and removal from office of the last president that got impeached, which was Park Geun-hye, back in 2017. That court hears the case. It takes months. There's different charges of impeachment that they will hear, and they decide which ones are valid and which ones are not. The problem there was that court did not have a quorum. At the time of his coup, there was three members that needed to be appointed. The guy that succeeded him, this acting prime minister, Han, he would not appoint anybody to the court. And so it meant that the court's work was stymied because, you know, they didn't have a quorum to do the work. And so the opposition party that still has a majority in the National Assembly impeached him as well. And so then now a third leader has come in, who's an acting president, and he has appointed the members of the court. So the court will be able to hear the case, but they have this arrest warrant for him because he was charged by the police, the national police, for insurrection. In the last few days, you know, he surrounded himself with the Presidential Security Service and refused to accept the arrest papers and refused to be arrested. And so now that arrest warrant has been renewed, it remains to be seen, you know, what's going to happen. He's trying to stir up all his right-wing supporters, and they come out, but they're not anywhere near. There's millions of people in the streets wanting his removal. And there's, you know, 10 to 20,000 of these rabid supporters that gather in front of his residence every day. And they're, you know, vastly outnumbered by the people that want him out. And a lot of people don't realize that a U.S. commander is in charge of the Korean military in times of war, right? So if there had been a war with North Korea during this time, a U.S. commander would be running the Korean military. And at all levels, the South Korean and U.S. military have very close relationship and very close links. The U.S. is usually informed beforehand of troop movements, major troop movements, and they've been informed beforehand in the past about declarations of martial law where troops under U.S. and Korean command take part. And the U.S. has been completely silent on this. It's unclear to me what exactly they knew about this or if they did know about it beforehand. All that remains to be seen and, you know, may not come out for years. It's put the U.S. in its quandary because Biden and Blinken put together this, and I should add Kurt Campbell, who's the Deputy Secretary of State, who was a big player in all this, put together this trilateral relationship, as you said earlier, to confront China and also any other threat to U.S. interests. Japan and South Korea and the U.S. military will work together in, you know, future military operations. But to do that, they needed this right-wing pro-Japanese politician in South Korea. And that's what they got with Yoon. And they desperately want to have that same kind of president again. And what will happen if he is impeached by the Constitutional Court is as soon as the guilty verdict is rendered, if there's a guilty verdict, of which I'm pretty sure there will be, he is immediately out of office and there is an immediate election for president. Once he's impeached, which could take a couple months, say by March or April, there could be a snap election in South Korea. And it's almost certain that someone from the progressive left will be elected president because there's such a massive rejection of Yoon and his party. The U.S. does not want that. The U.S. was very unhappy with Moon Jae-in, the past progressive president who opened the talks with North Korea and really tried to create a peace regime in Korea. The U.S. doesn't want that. With Trump coming in, Trump's just like, you know, South Korea should pay more for U.S. forces. Trump sees Japan as the real close ally of the U.S. in Asia and really doesn't care much for South Korea as an ally. And there's a lot of concern, of course, in both South Korea and Japan of what Trump's policies are going to look like.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, you just have no idea what Trump is going to do. I mean, he's just so random.
We don't. I mean, you know, he's talking about invading Greenland now. Taking back the Panama Canal, Americans, I don't think, are ready to send their sons and daughters to fight for Greenland. Who knows what he'll do in Korea and with China or Japan, anything. But we know that, you know, he's a super imperialist. I mean, he's a different kind of imperialist, but he wants to use the big stick like Theodore Roosevelt did, right? That's an unknown. But I think South Korean people have really stood up. It's interesting that this has happened just as the time that Jimmy Carter died, and there's all these accolades for Jimmy Carter. I'm probably the only journalist who's written about Carter in the negative sense about what he did in Korea, because the first thing people remembered about when Yoon tried this declaration of martial law, people immediately thought of Kwangju and, you know, how the people resisted with arms against the martial law regime then and how so many people were slaughtered by the South Korean military. And Jimmy Carter, at that time, when there was an uprising against martial law, against military rule, Jimmy Carter decided with the Pentagon to put that uprising down. They saw it as a threat to U.S. national security interests. They helped put down this citizen uprising that is now seen as sort of the first step towards its democratic revolution that happened later in the 80s, right, 1987. Jimmy Carter was involved in that. And so it's reminded a lot of us, I wrote about Kwangju for years and I'm still writing about it, and it's such a big part of Korean history now. And Jimmy Carter was on the wrong side of that. It was all for national interests. And so right now, the same thing, you know, Biden and Blinken say that we have an ironclad alliance with South Korea. But who is the alliance with? It's often not with the Korean people themselves, but the alliance is with this right-wing pro-military group in South Korea that somehow won the last election. But they always favor the right in South Korea. That's what the U.S. does. You know, they want right-wing, pro-American people that will go along with the American policy no matter what. You know, it's very similar in a lot of ways, but it's unclear to me what exactly the role was of the U.S. military in this situation. But it's got to be a dicey situation for them because these are troops that, you know, in times of war fall right under their control. And so that's why, you know, the U.S. is always informed of these troop movements because their job officially is to guard against North Korea crossing the border. And so they have to know where troops are at all times, especially the ones that are guarding the DMZ. That does raise a lot of questions about exactly what the U.S. role was here. They say, well, we hope the democratic process, you know, wins out. But what they're really saying is we hope that the democratic process wins out and they once again reelect a right-wing president.
To conclude, what is it with the trash balloons coming from North Korea? The whole thing sounds crazy, as do many stories about the country, but what's the reality?
The reality is they see lots of trash, other kinds of trash coming from the south that's allowed, right? They send these balloons north. they has propaganda balloons and stuff like that. Maybe it's seen on one hand, it's a nasty thing to do, you know, garbage landing in people's yards and all over the cities and stuff like that. But it's like, I think it's this message like, you know, if we wanted to send, you know, arms, or we wanted to, some of these garbage balloons have landed on the Blue House where the president lives, right? So it's like, you know, if we wanted to send military bombs or whatever, we could, but we're sending garbage instead. It's kind of a signal that, you know, hey, we're here. Don't underestimate, you know, our military power kind of thing. The last thing I'd like to say here is that, you know, there's a lot of talk now about North Korea being allied with Russia and having troops defending against the Ukrainian incursion into that part of Russia. Apparently those troops are there, but like North Korean military alliance that was recently signed with Putin, and that relationship didn't come together until only after the U.S., Japan, and South Korea signed their military alliance. And the North Koreans looked at that military tie between part of Korea and the former colonizer as South Korea completely rejecting the idea of unification by peaceful means, and instead allying itself with Japan. And Kim Jong-un made a big statement, new policy, we're now divided, we're two different sovereign countries. So we will sign a military alliance with whoever we want. The alliance with Russia was signed after this trilateral U.S.-Japan-South Korea alliance was created. And I think that's very important in terms of understanding the North Korean policy since then.
That was the journalist Tim Shurok, who's been writing about South Korea for a long time. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another bit of Y2K-era nostalgia, Elevate Me Later by Pavement. The song was released in 1997, the dawn of that era by Colette Shade's Reckoning. Till next week, bye.